Hey everybody, Brad here. For this weekend's episode, we're doing something a little bit different. What you're about to listen to is an interview I did with Congresswoman Nancy Mace, a newly elected representative from South Carolina. We spoke for an interview for the Washington Examiner magazine, but you get to listen to our full conversation here on the podcast.
You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.
For conservatives and Republicans across the country who are just getting outside of South Carolina, who are just getting to know you, who is Nancy Mace?
A very hard worker. I'm someone who's had a lot of stumbles in life. I've had a lot of second chances. And I know that through my life experiences over 43 years that if I work hard, I can literally achieve anything. You're talking to someone who dropped out of school at the age of 17 and whose first job was as a waitress at a Waffle House. And I learned some very tough lessons during some very tough times in my life. And the value of hard work is what's gotten me through every single challenge in life, including the one that we're in right now in Congress as well.
So I know that you were the first woman to graduate from the Citadel. So could you talk about that and how your military school background shaped you?
Yeah. So I had some pretty traumatic experiences in my youth. I was raped at the age of 16. I talked about that as a state lawmaker about 2 years ago, but that was the reason that I dropped out of school. And my parents said, if you're going to stop going to school, then you're going to start going to work. And I took that job as a waitress at the Waffle House. But about a year later, that was in 1995, and I was able to take some night courses at a local college and get high school credit and got my diploma in about 6 months. But that was in 95. And then in 1996, the Citadel decided to let women in. And my father is a graduate of the Citadel. He was in the military and the Army for 28 years. In fact, I was born at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, when my dad was with the 82nd Airborne. My father was the first commander of the first ever Ranger Training Brigade at Fort Benning in the mid to late 80s. And so he's a man that I admire deeply. And because he was a Citadel grad, I knew that if I followed in his footsteps at the Citadel, that maybe I too could achieve something in my life. Because at that time in my life, I really struggled. I had challenges unlike anything else. And I said to myself personally, I knew that if I could make it at the Citadel, if I could make it there, I could literally make it anywhere.
Do you think teenage you would be surprised to learn that you'd be elected to the United States Congress?
Teenage me would be shocked that I'm still alive. I literally lost all hope for my future during some very troubling, traumatic times in my life. And the Citadel, really, that military college experience really reshaped my life. And I literally credit it with that experience, no matter how challenging it was, with literally saving my life. Because to be able to go through that and say that I succeeded, I know that I can take whatever life throws at me. Hell Week in the Citadel, Hell Week in Congress, whatever you want to call it. I've seen this before. I've seen this movie before, and I know how to operate.
So let's talk a little bit about the formation of your political beliefs. When did you first become kind of politically aware? Where did you start out? And what kind of shaped your beliefs from the get-go as a young adult?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the Citadel is such a popular institution. We would see elected government officials come through from time to time. In fact, I met Senator Fritz Hollings when I was probably a freshman cadet at the Citadel. We met a lot of elected leaders, but I didn't really, when you're 18, 19, 20, you don't really understand sort of the role that those folks have in government or in our communities and in our state. And I honestly didn't really pay a whole lot of attention. And I know in my 20s, I know I've been voting since I was 18. I know as soon as I turned 18, I started voting. But I wasn't like someone that probably voted in every Republican primary, right? I knew that you voted every 4 years for president. I knew some elections were every two, and mayoral elections were different. But it wasn't probably until I had my kids when I really started to pay a lot more attention to what was going on politically. And when I had my son in 2006, and I was still in the corporate world, but in 2008, when I was pregnant with my second child, with my daughter, I decided that I would go out on my own because I wanted to be at home with my kids, but I also wanted to have an opportunity to work. And so I started my own company in 2008. And then 2 years later, in 2010, was when Mick Mulvaney and Tim Scott ran for Congress for the first time. And I was living in Atlanta, Georgia at the time, and I still had ties to South Carolina, because one of the things for me, coming out of the Citadel and being so well known in not only Charleston, but in the state of South Carolina, I wanted a little bit of anonymity as I was trying to establish myself in business. And so I actually moved away from the state for over 10 years, probably, so that I could establish myself, establish some sort of credibility outside of the Citadel. I didn't want to be just known for that. I wanted to be successful in my business career as well. But while I was in Atlanta, while I was pregnant with my, after I had my both of my kids, this would have been in 2009 or so, but I picked up Mick Mulvaney and Tim Scott as clients. And my business was primarily in PR and communications. And I did a lot of like email communications for them, built websites for them, probably helped on some social media a little bit as well. It was still pretty new back in 08, 09, 10. Facebook was sort of becoming a thing, but it wasn't like a real thing. And you know, people weren't really sure what kind of effect it would have on elections back then. Certainly not what it has now, being as impactful now versus 10 years ago. But when I saw and I met Mick and I met Tim for the first time and just saw how hard they work, how smart they were, the kind of things that I thought they could achieve in their roles in Congress, I was really excited to be a part of that. And it is sort of like when the political bug bites you, it's really hard to let it go. It's almost like an obsession. And I'm kind of the kind of person, when I get focused on something, I don't stop until I win or until I get what I'm looking for, or I set a goal and I achieve it. I literally will not stop. When I have a goal set in mind, I won't stop until I get it. And but meeting Mick and Tim and being part of their campaign in that way, I just admire them both so much, and I still do 10 years later, and look at their achievements over the last decade. It's very remarkable. And South Carolina has turned out a lot of great political leaders. But that was in 2010. And then a couple of years later, I decided that I would run for the U.S. Senate as a 35-year-old of two mom of two young kids. And I learned what it was like to have a campaign and what tremendous loss feels like. And I said, I don't think I like politics anymore. I really don't want to do this. I don't like to lose. I don't like losing. But in 2017, my state House rep, I was back in Charleston. I moved back in 2011, 2012. And my state House rep had resigned. And I, in South Carolina, when you have a resignation midterm, it triggers a special election. And in South Carolina, special elections are like 8 to 10 weeks. And I said, well, if I really want to do this, now is the time to do this. I can do anything for 8 weeks. And I raised about $100,000, close to that, in the first 2 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks. And then I ran a race unlike any other. I ran a race like I learned on Donald Trump's campaign in 2016 when I worked on his campaign. I ran a very much a grassroots sort of operation. I raised money and I had a ground game. And I had a remarkable time. And I had 3 elections to get elected to the State House of Representatives. So I became seasoned in how to campaign. And I'm really proud of the work that I did in 3 years as a state lawmaker. And
so I want to touch on that. I want to touch on that, yeah. But I want to rewind for 1 second. What was it in terms of your ideology, limited government, fiscal conservatism? What was it about becoming a mother, starting your own business? How did you come to hold those positions?
Yeah, well, learning really from Mick and Tim and seeing the work that they've done, I really identify as a limited government Republican, fiscally conservative. I don't want the government to take more of its fair share than it needs. Obviously, as someone who believes in the free market, who's been in business for over 20 years, I believe that the private sector could do a much better job than the government sector. I mean, if everything operates like, big government agencies, I mean, that's just it's just not efficient. With our tax dollars, where business can do so much better with so much less. And an understanding that, kind of coming from that worldview, but also, I also categorize myself as small L libertarian, who comes from a military family. So in the area where I live today, it's not your traditional sort of Republican district. We very much have an independent streak here. We always have had that. And I love that about the first congressional district. I love that about the Low Country, is that we're not always, beating our chest with red meat. We elect people who are willing to reach across the aisle and stay true to their principles, stay true to the Constitution, but also find ways to work together. And we saw that when Tim was in Congress. You saw that with Mick when he was there as well. There, and Mick has that kind of small L libertarian limited government kind of streak. And in fact, my LD, my legislative director that I hired, comes from Mick's shop. And so for me, it was really important, you know, to recognize, hey, where I come from, and ensure that the legislation that I work on in Congress is going to be similar to the legislation I worked on as a state House rep, but it keeps the Constitution literally as my guide. The founding fathers created an enormous instrument to guide us in all things, and they did a really good job, and they thought through many different obstacles we might face as a nation, and that document is held up for hundreds of years.
So this brings me to an interesting question, right? Because as a single mm-hmm. mother, and from what you've said about your backstory, some people would think, well, mm-hmm. you are the people that progressive big government is supposed to yeah. help. You're the kind of people that yeah. need the government to lift you up, right? So obviously yeah. you don't believe that, but can you talk about why?
No. Yeah. You know, and I hear from a lot of like Democrat women or independent women who are CEOs, or they have their own companies. And while they might be identified with the Democratic Party by and large, one of the things that they don't identify with is having the government be all things to all people, because these women have achieved so much on their own without the government's help. And they've proven that if you set a goal, you have a dream, you set a goal, you work hard, you can achieve it. And someone for me, like coming out of the place where I was, where I was a high school dropout and wasn't sure where I would go, I made some decisions that were very bad for me at that time. But over time, I made some very good decisions that brought me out of a very dark place and helped me become successful. I knew the decision to go to the Citadel, I knew what I was getting out of that. I knew that if I graduated, that I would have the strongest alumni network for any college in South Carolina, maybe the Southeast, maybe the United States. They have a very tight alumni network. And I knew that if I wanted to go into business, if I wanted to be successful, I had to be able to network and build relationships with people. I'm gonna turn my phone off to do that. But on my own, I didn't need the government to tell me what to do. But on my own, I was able to make decisions to improve the quality of my life and the outcome in my life. And so my life, I'm literally a walking story about how you can come from nothing and then achieve something. And I also think because I am conservative, because of the background that I do come from being a single mom, I know that our conservative ideology is very compassionate, but as a party as a whole, we have not done as good a job as we could showing that compassion. Because when people think of Republican, they think cold, they don't want the government to help you, they think unfeeling, that we don't care. And that's just simply not true. We do care enormously. We want the best outcomes for all the children and all of our kids for everyone's future. And it's one of the reasons that I work on things like prison reform, that I've reached across the aisle and worked with Democrats, or worked with African American members of the state legislature, for example, to get some things done. I think it's really important that we show that compassion. And that's the mom in me coming out to do that, because I know that if I'm successful within the Republican Party, then we can be successful everywhere.
So that raises an interesting point, because there's been a lot mm-hmm. of talk about Republicans losing suburban women, declining share of the female vote. What do you think yeah. the GOP has to do to convince more women and single moms that it's not just the progressives that care about them? Just because they don't support the right. government, that doesn't mean they don't care about you.
Yeah. Right. No, but we need to have more women run for office. This was a year where we had a record number of Republican women, and they're conservative women that they run for office. We need to have women from all walks of life, all colors, come forward to run for office, because the only way we can win races is if we actually raise our hand and stand up and run. And you need candidates that are qualified, candidates that can raise money, candidates that can win, quite frankly. And so I think that's really important that we support those women who have a chance to be able to do that, but also telling our stories. And the problem, one of the challenges that we face as Republican women, is that our stories, and we're not as sexy as the squad and socialism that some fringe members of the media have embraced and said, hey, this is sexy, cool. And we're not that. And so we've got to find our own avenues, our own paths to sort of to tell some of those stories. I've had an opportunity, I think, in the last couple of days and weeks, certainly, that I didn't think I would have, to be able to have a strong voice within the party as a female member. And now I want to use that for good and help us make some gains in the future.
So I definitely see what you're saying. It's important to have candidates mm-hmm. that represent the population, but where is the line between needing representation and women and minority candidates and the kind of mm-hmm. identity politics that the Democrat Party has really succumbed yeah. to? What's the dividing line, like, in terms of how
yeah,
far
and Republicans
you go?
As a Yeah, and Republicans as a whole, we don't do identity politics. It's not something I talked about when I was running for office. It's something you talk about after you win. It is a nice story. It's a heartwarming story that people really like. But when you have a minority candidate or you have a female candidate, there is, I think, a very strong likability factor in many ways, because there's a need for it, and that you've got to be qualified. I think that, you know, the preface that I always use is that we have qualified candidates that identify with us. But you have to run, but we don't run on identity politics. So our races are very much different, because we don't use that or try to use that to our advantage, because often in Republican circles, if you do, it's actually to your disadvantage, particularly in primaries. But once you win, seeing the stories, seeing the way we were covered, our freshman class was covered with our folks, our African American, Cuban American, Hispanic American, Asian American, women, combat vets. The Republican Party did a really good job after the election cycle in November to really showcase some of the diverse faces that we have embraced in this year's election cycle.
So I want to talk more about the freshman class, because I think it is historic yeah. in a lot of ways. But first, to kind of break out the different groups within that class, what camp, mm-hmm. broadly speaking, of conservatism or today's Republican Party, you know, you have different camps. What camp would you put yourself in, broadly speaking?
I'm in a camp of one. I'm in a caucus of one. I rely on the Constitution as my guide. Like, literally read the Constitution in the first few votes that I've had. That is my guide. I swore an oath to it, had my hand on it when I was getting sworn in on January 3rd. And so I'm part of the Republican Conference. I may join one or two others, but really, I consider myself a caucus of one, because my district, I believe, is unlike many of the other Republican districts. And I promise to be an independent voice. I'd be conservative, constitutionally conservative, fiscally conservative, limited government, but that I would also be an independent voice for my district.
When you look at the rest of the freshman caucus or the freshman class mm-hmm. that you're a part of, what has your experience been like with these other representatives? And just generally speaking, do you think that the class kind of represents a future path forward for the GOP?
Yeah, well, I love Ronald Reagan's 11th commandment, so I'm not going to speak ill of any of my Republican colleagues. I would say we're as diverse in our ideology as we are in the way that we look and the diversity and inclusiveness that we brought into Congress this year. I have very deep concerns about those who embrace QAnon and QAnon conspiracy theory. Theorists. I've been very vocal about that within my own party. For me, when I look at the future of the Republican Party, that is the only detriment that we have going on in our future, is to ensure that we don't allow QAnon conspiracy theorists to lead us into another constitutional crisis like we just experienced on January 6th. And so I've been very vocal about that, of what we have to do in order to reconcile that within our own party. And the first thing that we have to do, and this kind of goes to, you know, January 6th was horrific. And I think it was even more so because it was on the steps of the Capitol. We hadn't seen that kind of violence, that kind of insurrection, since 1812. And so because of the gravity of the situation, of the trauma that happened, of that, the anarchy that happened that day, I've really focused on holding Republicans accountable for that, because we can't point fingers at the other side, at the Democrats or at the left, who have violence and fringe issues on their side of the party, if we don't first take responsibility for our own mess, if we don't take responsibility of our own house. We can't point to others and ask them to do the same, to take responsibility for what they've done in this country as well. So I've been very vocal on that. But one of the things that, and this goes for Republicans and Democrats, quite frankly, is that, one, we've got to acknowledge we have a problem in this country with division. And you're seeing, you know, elements of both parties, the fringes of the right and the left within our own parties. We're seeing division over the last 4 years happening, more so with Republicans, you know, earlier on, but in the last 6 months or so, it's been on our side that we've seen a lot of this division, I believe. But the first thing we've got to do is acknowledge that we have a problem with divisiveness, with rhetoric in this country, within our own party. And the second thing we've got to do is take responsibility for it and acknowledge it, take responsibility for it. And the third thing is to stop it. We can't continue the division. Republicans and Democrats, for example, recently weaponized impeachment. Impeachment wasn't meant to be weaponized in that manner. And that's what we've done. And it's heartbreaking for me to watch, but that's one of the reasons I've been a vocal member of my own party, and I will continue to do so until we can get to where we need to be nationally and find some way to heal.
So there, like you mentioned, I mean, there is this fringe portion of the Republican base and now elected officials that's gone for some conspiracy theories like QAnon.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is, where does this come from, and what do you do about it as a party and as a movement to get to correct course?
I have no idea. So like I've been asked about QAnon in the past, and I sort of brushed it off, and I'm like, okay, this has got to be a joke, right? This isn't for real. But after January 6th, I did a bit of research, and I realized there are people in this country, a lot of people in this country, who believe some of the bullshit that has been promulgated by QAnon over the last 4 years. And it's only been around, I guess, the last 4 years, not previous to that. And so I don't know how it started. I don't know why people believe this stuff. I mean, to me, it's just crazy. And I don't know how you pull people out of it who truly believe that that's what's going on in this country. And it's very scary. And especially when we look at the events of January 6th, what some of that rhetoric led to. I mean, there were literally rioters hunting down members of Congress. I read a police report a couple of nights ago, and there were rioters who knew that there were some members of Congress stuck in the tunnels underneath the Capitol. And at one point during this, I was stuck in the tunnels underneath the Capitol, and they were trying to hunt us down and find us to capture us. And the fact that there are people that believe this shit is astounding and shocking to me.
So one other kind of question that the GOP will be wrangling with in the medium term future is on matters of foreign policy. You have kind of an America First wing that is more restrained on foreign policy, that was kind of pioneered by people like President Trump, people like Rand Paul. And then you have kind of the more establishment conventional thinking, more neoconservative or establishment type hawkish foreign policy. Which camp do you subscribe to, and which do you think is the future of the party?
The America First camp on foreign policy. I supported President Trump when he wanted to withdraw troops from the Middle East. I do believe his policies on how he operated in the Middle East were very good for us as a nation. If you look at the amount of money that we spend just on Afghanistan alone, that's over $50 billion a year for a war that appears endless at this juncture. And so I did support him very strongly on his Middle Eastern policy in that regard, and would continue that policy in the future, and would support that in the future.
One other thing that I found interesting about President Trump is that he sort of broke the mold on what it means to be socially conservative, in the sense that the Trump administration was very pro-life, it was very pro-religious liberty, but it also took a much more kind of conciliatory, or you could even say libertarian, tone on things like gay rights. So that has been a kind of a bridge issue between young Republicans and old kind of conventional social conservatives. So what do you make of that, and where do you place yourself on that spectrum?
Well, I believe that was a great example for the Republican Party, seeing the President of the United States really embrace that. And you saw him at his rallies. I saw him in a photo holding a LGBTQ flag. So that is something that's really important. And I know that in my own race, I came out pro-gay marriage and pro-cannabis as well. You know, that is something, and recognizing climate change is happening in our around the world. These are all things that are important to young Republicans. And if we can include that, you know, as part of our platform and include Republicans that have those same beliefs, then we're going to be able to continue to grow our party in the future. When I was a candidate for Congress, I was also endorsed by the Log Cabin Republicans. So these are issues that I have embraced, that I do not shy away from. I think it's really important that when we talk about equality, we talk about equality and we do it in the right way. And that's where most of America is anyway. I think most Americans believe that they are fiscally conservative, moderate on some social issues. They're probably pro-life or may not be. They respect those that are, but don't want the government in their businesses or in their bedrooms. I think that is the most Americans, the way that they believe.
Well, that brings me to an interesting question, because we are about to see, under President Biden and a thin but Democrat-controlled Congress, a push to get the government more involved in all sorts of things. So I guess, what do you think the priorities should be for the GOP over these next 2 to 4 years in terms of areas to really stand your ground and try to push back against?
Fiscal policy. I mean, there's only going to be so much we're going to be able to try to push back on, because we are in the minority party. We lost the House, the Senate, and the White House. I really hope that the Senate stands their ground right now on some of the negotiations that are happening, that we don't lose the filibuster. You know, as an example, so that we can at least be able to have some checks and balance on a Biden administration and on Nancy Pelosi in the House. I mean, I really worry about these things. But most Americans were hurting, especially those who are out of work or have lost wages due to COVID-19. There are small businesses around the country who are also suffering. And so that has to be our primary focus, is getting our economy back on track. That means getting the vaccinations out the door so that we can curb and slow down coronavirus, but also finding a way to not only keep people safe from COVID-19, but also reopening our economy. So I look at states like Florida, my home state of South Carolina, where I am today. I know right now our unemployment is hovering just over 4% in the state of South Carolina, far lower than the national average, because we were able to make some decisions that were pro-business, fiscally conservative, but also kept people safe from COVID and reopen our economy. Previous to COVID-19, we were just under 2%. So we're almost back to pre-COVID numbers in terms of employment. And there are employers looking for employees right now. So if you want a job, there are jobs and opportunities out there right now for us. But that's not the case in every state. And if you look at, so I read an article the other day, yesterday probably, California, that's been one of the most shut down states in the country. And you look at Florida, who's been largely open through almost the entire thing with some guidelines in place. And they've cut back on some of the times you can go out and you know, but they've kept kids in school. They've kept their athletics going. South Carolina has been very limited in that regard. But if you look at like Florida to California and how well Florida is doing compared to a state like California, it's sort of mind boggling to see that they've done such a great job. And South Carolina is the same way. I mean, our unemployment, people are working, people who need to stay home are staying home. I mean, we've done a remarkable job of balancing COVID-19 and keeping our hospitals open. We're struggling right now on vaccinations. That's a real problem for us, since we're 50th in the country and the percentage or ratio of vaccinations per 100,000 people. That's something that we're all working on diligently right now and furiously. But overall, by and large, I think that's one of the reasons you see Florida, Tennessee, Texas, South Carolina as some of the states that folks from California or New York, New Jersey are moving to, because we've balanced freedom and health and safety and allowed people to keep their jobs.
So an interesting question then is, they've blown out trillions of dollars, $3 trillion and counting, on COVID relief. And now President Biden wants nearly $2 trillion more, including expanded unemployment benefits through September and a $15 national minimum wage. Do you think something still needs to be done? And are you going to be against this package and pushing back on those kinds of big government approach?
Stands, yeah, this is a big government approach. We don't have the money. We don't have $2 trillion to give away. And in previous stimulus packages, we saw people who were not citizens, who were dead, who got checks. I mean, millions of dollars wasted. I know that if you're making $75,000 a year, the average American's going to say, hey, you're making $75,000 a year and your income wasn't, your salary or wages were not affected negatively by COVID-19. Why are you getting a stimulus check? I know for me personally, I qualify for stimulus check, but the reason my salary, my wages were down this year, wasn't because of COVID-19, it was because I decided to run for Congress. That was a personal choice that I made. It wasn't COVID that lowered my income. I did it because I ran for Congress. So I shouldn't qualify for a stimulus check. And so if we are going to do anything, and well, number one, mandating a $15 minimum per hour wage has nothing to do with COVID-19. The problem that with these packages that are being shoved down the throat of Congress is that oftentimes they're slipping in things that literally have nothing to do with COVID-19. And it's ridiculous. The American people really do deserve better. And I think less can really be more. So the people who are truly, truly been affected, their wages are down from COVID-19, they've lost their jobs, or small businesses who have had to be shut down, those are the ones we should be targeting, and only those individuals and small businesses. Everyone else that's back at work and hasn't been affected, that they shouldn't be getting that kind of financial benefit. The other thing that I think that we should really look at too is for some parents, working parents, and having their kids at home. Like for instance, my kids haven't been able to go to school since March of last year. They haven't set foot inside their school. They've been at home. But there are parents who've had to take on greater financial responsibilities at home for childcare. I'd want to make sure that they can write off those expenses or get some help as needed for those, because if their schools are shut down, my kids are a little bit older, so I haven't had to incur that, but there are those that aren't quite as fortunate or in the same situation. I've managed, it's been very difficult for us, but I've managed through friends and family to be able to balance it all, but not everyone is as lucky either.
So that brings an interesting question, because for a lot of people, mm-hmm. the COVID-19 crisis and school shutdowns, right, which initially I think mm-hmm. most people understood, but have really become this dragged out issue from unions fighting to keep public schools shut down. And a lot of parents have left wishing they had a choice, wishing they could send their kid elsewhere. They had a private voucher. They had a charter school. So how has, what is your general kind of disposition on education issues, and how has the COVID-19 shutdowns informed it?
I was a big school choice person before COVID, but COVID-19 just proved that, hey, we need more choices for our children. My kids are stuck in a system right now where they don't get to go back to school. I think next month they're going to start by allowing them to go in person 2 days a week. Not enough. I'd love the option to be able to be in school 3 days a week. I think that's what my kids really need at this juncture, but we don't currently have that option in the school that they're in, unfortunately. But if parents had more choices, they could make better decisions for themselves. There are some parents who are at home and are okay with the virtual schooling that their kids are going through because they have the time, the ability, and the resources to do that. I don't. I work full time. The father of my kids, he works full time too. We can't. We've relied really on our 11-year-old and a 14-year-old to trust that they're doing everything they need to be doing. And this isn't always the case. We've really struggled this year, but I was a huge school choice person, and part of COVID-19 has really shown us that those who are not faring well are going to fare worse during this pandemic, and those who are hurt worse really should be the ones back in school. And the other thing that I want to mention too is that we really got to use science, right? The left always talks about, well, let's make decisions based on science. Well, I saw some data in one of the counties in my congressional district where they shut down temporarily after Christmas, but the percentage of COVID students in school that had COVID was less than 1%, was like 0.7%, maybe half of a percentage point. So the decisions are being made on an emotional basis, not a scientific basis. And so there are a lot of families that are struggling out there. Their kids are struggling even worse. And we really ought to use science to make and be informed on those decisions.
Yeah. And is this another issue where you see a conservative opening to appeal to working moms and minorities and the people who are rich? People always have school choice, right? The wealthy can always just send their kid to some bougie private school.
Right.
So do you think this is an issue where the GOP has an in to help and appeal to new types of voters?
I do. I really do. It's something that, you know, without previous to the election and the events of January 6th was something that we talked a lot about, trying to be supportive of those families. But in some cases, like in the state of South Carolina, where the governor was trying to use some of those resources for vouchers, got shut down in court. And so those were Democrats that sued the state of South Carolina to to not allow working families, those who have been struck the hardest, who have our low income working families, the opportunity to send their kids to a better school. It was really, it's sad to see that happen, but that's what happened here. That's why we weren't able to do it.
And I know that you mentioned Senator Tim Scott as somebody who inspired mm-hmm. you and you worked for in politics. One of the things he's spoken about is obviously not the kind of progressive vision of systemically racist America and everything, how they portray it, but he's spoken about the real reality of racism for him and being pulled over in D.C. by police officers, even though he's a member of the Senate. And he's also introduced some police reforms. So I guess, what is your disposition on those issues in terms of approaching criminal justice and racial issues in a slightly different way than old-fashioned law and order Republicans?
Yeah, no, I admire Senator Scott and hope he will continue to share those stories with people, because many of us can't understand what that's like. And when you talk to, like, when you talk to like a young African-American male, they grew up understanding that when they're driving down the road, their hands are to be at 10 and 2 on the steering wheel while they're driving, and especially when they're pulled over, and how to, you know, react. I've got a kid that one of my favorite restaurants on Daniel Island that I visit here in my hometown. Last year he was pulled over like 10 times. I don't know that I've been pulled over 10 times in my lifetime, let alone a year. And so we do have to recognize that there are disparities in different populations. And I admire Senator Scott for speaking up for that. As a state lawmaker, these were some of the issues that I really tried to champion. And in the middle of COVID earlier this year, in the middle of my congressional campaign, in the middle of COVID-19, I actually had a prison reform bill signed into law in the middle of all this earlier last year. And so these are issues that, as a Republican, I really feel like it's a place where we can reach across the aisle and show some of that compassion to work with members of both parties. And that's something that I've taken to heart and something that I've worked on. I really pride myself on reaching across the aisle. I am conservative. I mean, you look at my votes, I think I'm rated third or fourth as a state lawmaker, third or fourth most conservative state lawmaker in South Carolina when I was there. But at the same time, I had 100% rating with conservation voters because I wanted to work on environmental issues. And I had a prison reform bill signed into law last year.
So that raises an interesting question, which is, do you see any areas where you think you might be able to work with the Biden administration or a Democrat-controlled Congress? Or are there areas that you think you could, you would be open to bipartisan work and reforms?
There are. I think that's really incumbent upon us, especially given what our country's going through right now. I am not going to desert the Constitution or my fiscal conservative credentials like that. Those are two things that are non-negotiable for me as a lawmaker. But there are areas where we can work together. One of the things that we did as a state lawmaker was work on environmental policy with Democrats and Republicans together, and doing it in a way that didn't, you know, for instance, we worked on legislation to help increase solar in the state of South Carolina. We did it without subsidizing it, right? And so finding ways that we can, our goal is the same, and it's just how we get there will sometimes differ. Prison reform, criminal justice reform are other areas in addition to the environment where I think we can work together. Infrastructure and transportation, the only problem we have with T&I issues is how do we fund it? Because often we'll have these grandiose, you know, T&I bills that come through and there's no way to actually pay for any of it. But that's an area where I believe that we can work together on some of those issues. And the one of the things, the silver linings that came out for me in the first 2 weeks in office, because I've been so strong and vocal since the events of January 6th, was that Congressman Crist came to me to be the lead Republican sponsor on his resolution that would recognize Officer Goodman for a Congressional Gold Medal. And we have since added 90 other co-sponsors to the legislation. And so I believe there'll be more opportunity. I've heard from a lot of Democrats and Republicans who want to find ways to work together without compromising our principles.
So what do you see your goal, your time in Congress in the broader sense? What do you hope to achieve beyond just specific policies? What do you want to bring to the equation that you feel is lacking?
I want to bring a voice. I want to be a new voice for the Republican Party. I also believe in governing. I think it's one thing to throw a bunch of rhetoric and verbal bombs out there and weaponizing certain institutions within Congress, but it's another to actually try to accomplish something. And as difficult as that is in our Congress, especially when our Congress and our nation is so polarized and so divided right now, if I can find a way to work with both members of both parties to achieve some goals, to get some legislation passed, I do believe that small parts can make a big difference. That would be an enormous achievement for me. I don't want to be someone that just goes up there and screams into a microphone or screams into, you know, the latest, you know, news hit. I want to be someone that can be effective, be an effective leader, and be a new voice for the Republican Party, because we're going to need that going forward if we want to be successful in the future.
So I know we're about to wrap up, but to end on a slightly lighter note, what's a fun fact that most people won't know about you? And then what's your most controversial opinion about food?
Oh, controversial opinion about food. What do people not know about me? I love to cycle. So up until
Peloton?
No, I get on the road. I strap in. Okay. I strap my feet in. I haven't really, since I had COVID, I've struggled with my recovery a little bit. The other fact about me is I love playing Clue with my kids. Like, that's our favorite pastime. So when we turn the TV off or want to do something together as a family, we play Clue. I love Clue. I don't know what it is about having a mystery and trying to solve it. I like a good challenge, and that's something that we do as a family often. And I gave my daughter a Grogu for Christmas, and I told her if she didn't want it, that I would take it. So I love The Mandalorian. Have you seen The Mandalorian on Disney?
No, I'm the only one that hasn't in the world.
Okay. Okay, the little baby Yoda. The little baby Yoda. It's amazing. I love Grogu. And then food. I don't eat black licorice. I'm trying to think, what's my weirdest food thing? I don't know, other than I avoid black licorice like the plague.
I've heard some good ones from some lawmakers. Rand Paul went off about how much he hates mayonnaise.
Oh, see, I like everything. The only thing I can't stand is black. I will literally eat anything. I will literally try anything one time, as long as it's legal. Like, I will
try important qualifier.
Important qualifier. But I literally, other than black licorice, I will literally try anything. But I mean, especially in politics, like, I love a good cocktail. So if I have like an espresso martini, like, I just, one of my favorite things to have, just one at the end of a long day, especially a political day.
You drink your coffee hot thing. Or iced?
Hot. You know what? I just discovered the Nitro Brew at Starbucks. So I'm actually having, I'm actually having a coffee kegerator installed in my office for cold brew.
Wow. I'm jealous.
It's intense and it's fucking good. It is really, really good. It should have come last week, but because of the events, it didn't happen, but I'll get it probably next week. Yeah. Like, I want my office to be, if you want coffee, you can come to my office.
The cool office.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. And I drink coffee all day. I mean, I coffee is lunch and breakfast. So.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time.
You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.